Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we hear from the state veterinarian about the discovery of avian flu at an animal sanctuary in its flock of ducks and geese. The owner says some 70 birds have been destroyed. A swan, as well as more than a dozen zebra doves, are affected. So what can we expect to see if this disease spreads? We hear about good government reforms, a call for more transparency in the state house as new leadership prepares to take over next session. We learn why a native bird found only on Kauai now has a population in residence at the Honolulu Zoo. And what is it like to play your own ancestor in a film? We talk to one of the stars of an upcoming short film set in Hawaii's statehood era. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The discovery of avian flu in wastewater in the Waihewa area led to the destruction of some 70 birds at a backyard bird sanctuary on Friday. The nonprofit Duck Sanctuary posted that its flock of backyard ducks and geese and a swan were among the casualties, but so were a dozen or so zebra doves. Here to talk about this first outbreak of avian flu in birds in Hawaii is the state veterinarian, Dr. Isaac Maeda. The virus is highly contagious, so should we be worried about the populations of feral chickens and pigeons and doves that are widespread across the islands?
Feral birds and feral chickens, unfortunately, die all the time. And, you know, there are other things in chickens, feral chickens especially. We run into cases of botulism from eating spoiled food or material that they get into in the outdoors. But because of this detection, it's good for people to be vigilant. I don't think that feeding birds and making them aggregate in places is a good idea, because there's greater chance, if you have an introduction, that everything is going to get potentially exposed to it at the site if somebody's feeding all of that. And then you also bring them into closer contact with people, which is also not desirable.
The whole idea is that we want to avoid spreading this. I mean, it's out in the wild.
Right.
And the detection in the zebra doves made me wonder, because, you know, those are everywhere. And you just wonder then, if people do see dead birds, chickens, or pigeons on the side of the road, you know, how should they handle the carcasses?
Carcasses, if they're going to be handled, they should wear protective, as they say, PPE, personal protective equipment. And basically, it's gloves. I think if you're outdoors, probably not as critical, but if you have an N95 mask, that's fine. And the other thing they can do is call the Department of Health or the Department of Agriculture for guidance as far as protecting yourself, but not to handle them with bare hands and, you know, that kind of thing. We would accept the carcasses of birds that are found if they're diagnostic. If it's been out there for a while, unfortunately, it's not possible to use it to get any kind of diagnosis off of testing-wise or other. We'll do a telephone kind of comm first to establish what the situation actually is. If it's a pet bird, it's probably best to contact your private veterinarian directly. We have done outreach to the private veterinarian so that they are aware that if they examine something that looks or have a case that's suspicious, then they can contact us and we can arrange for testing and what have you.
What are the protocols that are in place? I mean, what are you telling other backyard sanctuaries, bird rescuers, you know, whether it's, you know, someplace on Maui like the Boo Boo Zoo or like this duck sanctuary?
Yeah, it's pretty similar. Be on the lookout for anything unusual in the way of illness, behavior, or deaths especially. This virus is usually fatal in poultry, so within a few days of introduction, if you have it, there's going to be dying birds, whether it's waterfowl or chickens or what have you. Yeah.
The duck sanctuary posted something on November 9th. They noticed something was wrong with their ducks and geese, and then, you know, last week we heard the health department step up and say, look, the threat to public health is low. You know, we are the last state, you know, to see this. But obviously, we just want to prevent the spread if we can. We have lots of native birds that are endangered or threatened, and we worry about them, too.
Right. the thing about the spread is one of the reasons why we took the step to actually remove the birds that was at that facility, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to eliminate the virus as much as possible to not have it spread to other birds. You know, if you have birds like waterfowl or doves, they tend to move, ducks can migrate, that kind of thing. So we're really trying to cut down on the spread of the disease.
Well, I've seen ducks over at swimming pools, you know, from Hawaii Kai to Kailua. And, yep. you know, over they were over at the state capitol in those reflecting ponds at one time. You know, they fly down from the Nu'uanu Stream. You know, but, you know, I'm thinking of places like the Honolulu Zoo, where they've got lots of zebra doves flying around. And obviously their birds, their captive birds, you know, you hope don't succumb to this. But are there additional housekeeping tips that you can give people?
By security-wise, you want to minimize traffic. If you have a facility, a premises that you have production, maybe it's kind of like similar to what commercial production facilities do. They restrict the people that can come into the facility. Some of them will actually have extensive cleaning or disinfection of people prior to dressing and then entering the facility, and same thing when they're leaving. But the other thing is to have, they also can conduct testing. For example, I'm not sure, you have to check with the Honolulu Zoo themselves directly, but I think they are increasing testing for avian influenza and some of their birds there. As far as surveillance and wildlife, that's one of the things we asked, and we're working with the wildlife services to increase targeted surveillance of wildlife, because we want to focus on the area that in central Oahu, but we also want to look elsewhere just to be sure we get the full picture.
It's tough to keep it out of the state, you know, when we have all these migratory birds coming and going. You know, I'm thinking of, I think at the James Campbell Wildlife Preserve, I think they had a Canadian geese land there. And so, yeah, it's tough to keep out, but we just need to be on alert and be mindful when we do see dead birds or dead chickens around.
Right. Vigilance is necessary, and it also kind of, you know, it allows us to be able to get an active picture of what's happening, and we can kind of figure if we have reports all coming out of a certain area, then that's a reason for us to get a little bit more intense about surveillance investigation in that area.
I did see when I was Googling that Hawaii chickens and eggs, I think, are banned from export to Guam. I didn't realize that we did that here. As I was looking back, I think that they had put a ban out when the outbreak happened, you know, a year or so ago, and Hawaii now has just been added to the list.
Anytime you have a detection of a disease like this, it does have the potential for affecting trade or export. So that's another reason of a concern of why we need to get it controlled, and we need to try and mitigate any type of spread of this thing.
Yeah, and our poultry producers have already been on high alert since the cases just swept the mainland. Because you would hate to see them have to destroy their flocks, you know, whether it's Kale eggs or, you know, other, our other poultry producers.
Yeah, absolutely. It has, on the continent, created a substantial, you know, economic and loss of food, because you had entire houses that had to be, you know, destroyed kind of deal.
Right. So that's why the price of eggs is through the roof.
Yeah. That is one of the reasons why eggs and meat products have increased. Yep.
Is there anything else that you think we ought to be bracing for? I mean, if we have a lot of feral chickens affected and they're laying around, is there a chance that this might jump over to, let's say, feral cat colonies?
You have, in theory, the ability, if these feral cats were to ingest an infected carcass, that they could get infected that way. I don't know what the interaction is. Actually, in feral cat colonies, generally they have a feeder or somebody that's going out there and feeding them. But there's always a potential for that. Or even, you know, any kind of bird, doesn't have to be a feral chicken. If it's an infected bird that dies, a cat could potentially pick it up that way. So if we have cat colonies that are also experiencing unknown deaths, then that would be another type of situation to investigate. I don't think the overall risk to the general, you know, home pet is high. But if you have aggregations of birds, bird feeders, and cat feeders kind of thing, then that would increase it.
Okay, but everybody's just got to be on guard, you know, extra vigilant,
right.
Whether you're raising chickens, you know, egg-laying chickens in your backyard, or whether you're a rescue group, a nonprofit, or you're a hotel where you have ducks and swans, you know.
Yeah, in general, you want to try and prevent commingling of wild birds and your stock. I mean, what you want to do is you want to keep wild birds out of your chickens or whatever that you're raising for yourself, because that's how introduction is going to likely take place. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other ways it could come in on people or whatever, but that's probably low potential, low risk versus coming in by a wild bird.
Okay. Well, is there anything that keeps you up at night knowing now that we've got cases here?
Well, just the fact that we need to try and get this under control, and then we need to get a better feel of what kind of migratory fowl could be involved in transmitting it. So a lot of more information that we need to have, I think. And what we're hoping for is that we don't start seeing it pop up on all the different islands.
Okay. Just here on Oahu for now.
Yep, for now.
All right. Okay. Anything else you want to underscore? Do you think we've covered it?
No, I think that's pretty much it.
Okay. All right. I mean, you don't want to necessarily alarm people, but we do have to understand what the risks are. And if you have pet birds or a flock of birds that you tend to, you just need to be extra careful.
Yeah. Like the Department of Health had mentioned, the risk to people is low. So we don't want to alarm people from that standpoint. As far as to their pet cats, again, there is a risk, but we don't expect that to be real high at this point because we don't find widespread detections on the island or the state. And as far as your backyard flock and what have you, again, you know, there is a risk, but if you can mitigate that by not having them commingle with wild birds and, you know, don't feed birds and that kind of thing, it really helps.
We have been hearing from Dr. Isaac Maeda, state veterinarian, about the discovery of avian flu in our state. Hawaii is the last state to have reported the disease, which some say is likely to have been spread here by migratory birds. If you do see an unusual die-off or see sick birds, you should contact the state agriculture department. We'll have links for the numbers to call on the conversation page of our website later today.
An enclave of Armenian Christians has lived in the old city of Jerusalem for centuries.
The Armenian presence in Jerusalem dates back to the 4th century.
Now the community says it's facing an unprecedented threat, a legal dispute over a controversial real estate deal that has the community worried for its future. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1, here on HPR 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Shuffling the deck. That's what's underway at the state legislature, with Kauai's Nadine Nakamura poised to take over as Speaker of the House next session. And with change comes opportunity. Some see the changing of the guard as the window to revamp the way the House does business. Here to talk about what's being proposed is HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so each House and the Senate have, you know, their own set of rules on each side, which they vote on every year to kind of govern, you know, anything from, you know, when public testimony gets uploaded to the powers that committee chairs have or what leadership can do and can't do. Those are all passed, and it's called the House rules or the Senate rules. And so several advocacy groups are pushing for changes to the House rules specifically, or, well, to the rules in general, but focusing on the House, to make the legislative process more transparent. The Hawaii Alliance for Progressive Action founder, Aria Castillo, says, you know, the current process makes people lose confidence in the way that bills are passed at the legislature.
If the process in general is broken and it's not even being given a fair hearing to hear both sides of the argument, I think that's where the frustration really starts, because you don't even have a fighting chance to get your bill is heard or moved on to the next stage, it feels like it's doomed from the start. So supporting these basic rules changes, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on, what political party you're on, whether you're fighting for something that's pro or con, getting the playing field a little bit more level is going to help everybody.
And she says that because, you know, when you're watching things go through the legislature every year, you know, the bills, there's a certain, set of rules that the bills go through, you know, three hearings on each on the floor, and then they go through committee. But all the little things in between where the bill goes, what committee it goes to,
confusing.
All those, yeah, conference committee, all of these like really confusing tiny things, deferring bills in committees, these are all governed by these House or the Senate rules. And so that's why they're focusing on these to maybe try to demystify some of the ways that bills can get through the legislature. So Hapa with Our Hawaii and Common Cause Hawaii are circulating a petition to get support for these changes. And, you know, they've gotten well over 1,000 signatures so far. And Castillo has been moving resolutions through neighborhood boards to get them to support some of these changes as well. Because, as you know, neighborhood boards often do try to bring legislation to the lawmakers or advocate for them as well. And although they want to change the rules in both chambers, the focus is on the House because, as you said, of the recent upheaval in leadership following the defeat of former House Speaker Scott Saiki when he lost the August primary to incoming Representative Kim Koko Iwamoto. So there are five changes they want, that these advocacy groups want, but I think one of the most significant and likely would be the way that bills are referred to in committee. One of the key changes is to, you know, where these bills go to each all the different subject matter committees. And those committees are important because the bill needs to get passed through to be voted on by the full legislative body. So in the House, the specific concern is with bills being referred to Finance Committee, even though they have no fiscal component. Here's Representative Amy Peruso, who's been fighting for these changes.
You have a very high percentage of bills that don't see a money committee referral in the Senate, but they see one in finance. And that's because the Senate uses a different referral process. The Senate has their drafting agency, so their equivalent of our HMSO, do their committee referrals. And that's a way to depoliticize which bills go to which committees. And I think that's really important because if you give one particular committee or one particular chair too much power, then they really create a bottleneck around the kind of work that we can do in the legislature.
And when she says HMSO, that's the House Majority Staffing Office, which is kind of a more like researchy branch of, you know, the legislature. And so when you're talking about the bottleneck, one clear example that kept getting brought up about this is, you know, the chaos that ensued during the 2023 conference committees, which was largely due to so many bills being referred to finance. And people were confused about, you know, where bills were being heard and lawmakers were yelling out bill numbers. People who were around during that time might remember it being called a cattle call. You know, everyone was crowded around outside. Bill numbers were just being yelled out and it was just complete chaos. Yes. So when you look at the number of bills introduced in each chamber, the Senate actually introduces more than the House. But the House Finance Committee has over 250 more bills referred to it than the Senate's counterpart, which is the Ways and Means Committee. So advocates say the House should have a process more similar to the Senate when referring bills so that it isn't just up to House leadership. Also, the House's current rules only give committee chairs the power to request to move bills in and out of their committees, which advocates say also puts pressure on them to deal with their colleagues in like a very transactional way. And committee chairs in general have so much power, which is why these advocacy groups are also calling for term limits for committee chairs. Another seemingly easy change that they're pushing for would be to make public testimony available at least 22 hours before hearings and at least 2 hours for late testimony. Currently, testimony is posted just like moments before hearings, if that, and advocates say it's just not enough time to review it and it prevents substantive discussion during committee meetings that's supposed to be happening. Younghee Overlee with the American Association of University Women had an experience like this when walking into a committee hearing while working on a paid family leave measure this most recent legislative session.
We show up and it's first time we see pretty lengthy opposition to paid family leave bill from a very reputable national organization, and we didn't get to see it until we got there. So as you could imagine, we were panicking. And because one was looking at specifically from like a Hey Data perspective. So the advocates were looking at me to figure out, well, how to respond. And I literally did the research on the spot to figure out why this group is objecting and what they're talking about and how to counter it. And talk of stress. Now, if I had a little more time to do the homework, I would have, you know, number one, it would have saved me from high blood pressure. Number two, I would have done a much better job at countering.
Yeah, it is a bit of a head scratcher because, I mean, back in the day, you know, all the testimony used to be printed and we used to have to go collect it every morning from the print shop, you know, and now it's all online. So, yeah, I just don't really understand why it's just not available to the public right away.
Yeah, and exactly. I think that's what a lot of advocates are saying. And also, you know, some committee chairs actually do this already voluntarily. You know, the House Judiciary and Hawaiian Affairs Committee Chair David Tarnas was brought up as someone who tries to abide by this early posting this testimony early so that you can have, you know, more substantive conversation in committees, which is where that's supposed to be happening, to adjust the bills, to, you know, add things, take things out. And people also say that that want this change, it would give people who want to testify more incentive to actually turn it in on time versus now there's not really much consequence to turning in late testimony besides like that late stamp on it that I guess can be a little embarrassing. But, you know, when you look at other forms of government, the Honolulu City Council also does this. You see, you know, the testimony uploaded a day at least before all of their committee hearings. And so, you know, these are just some of the steps that, you know, these advocacy groups want to see the House and, you know, for this public testimony thing, the Senate as well, take into account to make the process more transparent and easier to follow so that, you know, everyday people who are trying to, you know, advocate for bills, mm-hmm. advocate for things, can go to the legislature and actually understand what is going on.
Yeah, you want it streamlined, efficient, easy to read. I never really understood that, why some departments post things so much earlier than others. You know, they come up with excuses, but you're like, hey, if the Department of Land and Natural Resources could put all their submittals online a week before, why can't everybody else? Things
right,
like that.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, the new Speaker of the House, Nadine Nakamura, says she will be listening to all these suggestions that come in before the legislature reconvenes in January. And she did point out that in the past, they have made some significant changes to the rules, like allowing remote testimony. So, you know, we'll have to see as we go into the next legislative session in January to see what they propose as changes.
Okay, well, good luck and have fun.
Thanks.
All right, we've been hearing from our government reporter, Ashley Mizuo, about a push for more transparency in the House next session.
Here's what Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said when she learned that Peter Hegseth is President-elect Trump's pick to lead the Department of Defense.
Well,
what are your thoughts on that?
I just said, wow.
What you need to know about the Fox News host's military experience and extreme Christian theology. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater. Mana Music Quartet, along with guests Kimie Minor, Kalani Pea, and others, celebrates its new album, Journey Through Hawaii, November 24th. HawaiiTheater.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa,
Today, we're focused on a city on the continent with a surprising connection to the islands. In 1927, an enterprising businessman set up a fruit stand in California consisting of a three-story bamboo frame covered with palm fronds. For almost a decade, he sold soda and sandwiches from his shack. And the story goes that travelers could punch up their fruit punch with a bit of homemade moonshine. It was during the Prohibition era, so visitors came from far and wide, and eventually a small city grew around the fruit stand. It wasn't long before the city took on the name of this business, which stuck even after the shack disappeared. Today, this place is the smallest city in Los Angeles County and is home to such sites as Aloha Stacks Pancake House, Hawaiian Elementary School, and Aloha Health Medical Academy. The city's casino even features a replica of a volcano. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know what the city's name is. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
A tiny Hawaiian honeycreeper, the Aniani Owl, found only on Kauai, is now in residence at the Honolulu Zoo. Here's why. The population of the species has declined by 65% just in the past 5 years. So as extra insurance, a population of 10 birds was recently moved to Oahu. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to two scientists with the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project. Kelly Crampton is the project's leader, and Nicole Sukau is a avian research coordinator. She helped capture and transport the Aniani Owl. Crampton starts us off.
While Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project mostly focuses on threatened and endangered birds, we also collect data opportunistically on all the forest bird species that occur on Kauai. And one part of that effort is every 5 years, we do a range-wide survey that allows us to assess population sizes of the 8 species that occur on Kauai, native species. We also actually assess population sizes of the invasive species as well. And we've been doing that rigorously since 2000, so we have a really good data set at this point that allows us to assess trends as well as population sizes at any one point in time. And the most recent survey was in 2023, and it showed that Aniani Owl had gone through a two-third population decline. So they'd lost 65% of their species numbers compared to only 5 years earlier in 2018. And they had also had a two-thirds contraction in their range, meaning that they were occupying a much smaller portion of the Alakai Plateau on Kauai. So this was, you know, huge alarm bells to see a species go from 10,000 birds to only about 3,000 birds in a matter of 5 years. And we know that for Aniani Owl, like the other honeycreepers, avian malaria is the primary culprit of these declines. And while, as you know from our previous conversations, we are on the cusp of controlling mosquitoes which carry avian malaria on the Alakai Plateau, we're still a few months out, and we wanted to kind of hedge our bets against further delays in that mosquito control, or that it might take a little bit of time to actually cause mosquitoes to be suppressed, and make sure that we had some other tools in our belt to save the Aniani Owl. I made the initial outreach to Honolulu Zoo with the blessing of the forest bird biologists at Division of Forestry and Wildlife. And Honolulu Zoo was incredibly receptive because not only did they recently regain their accreditation, they are building a state-of-the-art forest bird building, which is completely mosquito-proof and climate-controlled and is the perfect place to launch a project like this. And actually, I Googled them last year, and they were one of the top, listed as one of the top zoos in the country. So they've come a long way since 2020.
Let's turn to the collection of the Anianiao. So, Nicole, maybe you can speak to how you identify birds and what the process of capturing them looks like.
A lot of the time, because they do stay up so high in the canopy, you'll hear them much sooner than you'll see them. But once anyone in the crew is hearing birds in a certain area or given just past surveys where they know that they have been, we'll set up mist nets in that area, anywhere from just a few nets to up to like 11 nets in a given territory to try and catch birds either with or without playback, which is playing their songs, their calls, just Anianiao vocalizations to lure them in. And then, yeah, we would collect them from the nets, we'd extract them, and quickly process them just to get important biometrics, their weight, and see if we can age them in the field before that first dose of meds and then bringing them in.
And so how many birds have you collected thus far, and how many are you aiming to collect?
Yes, we've sent 10 now to Honolulu Zoo.
That was the grant to collect
just 10.
But our permit allowed us to collect 2 more. And so we decided to go for the 2 more, which is what we've been doing this week when we've been so hard to get a hold of.
Are you having success so far?
Yes, we actually have 2 that we're monitoring right now and assessing whether or not they'll be good candidates for captivity. We have been trying to get, to the extent we can, younger birds. And so it's fairly easy to tell the birds that were born this year, and those have been a priority. But then anything older than that, we can't tell if they're 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years old, so that gets more complicated. We also can't tell in the field whether they are male or female. We have some guesses or some suspicion, but there's nothing about the size or color of an Anianiao that's a sure bet that it's a male or a female. So in an ideal world, you know, if you were working with a bird that was sexually dimorphic, you'd try to get half-half. But we haven't been able to do that. We've primarily been focusing on the age, and then secondarily just whether they settle well in their cage once we bring them back to camp, or whether they just don't settle down and eat. What are the other indications of being stressy, Nicole, that you guys observe in the ones in the field that we've let go?
In addition to how much they're eating, they prefer if they'll take multiple types of food. So if they're just eating insects, for instance, and they're not taking to nectar, that could be something to watch. It's preferred, the aviculturists prefer if they are taking a mixture, whether that's a fruit, they're offered papaya, for instance, and nectar and waxworms or any combination, just so long as it's more than one type.
I think I saw photos maybe on the Instagram account of some of the birds being held in these cages and maybe field technicians walking out of the forest holding them. And I just was like really fascinated by that process.
Yeah, so there's some areas where it's easy enough, but some areas when we're hiking them in those transport boxes, we kind of have to form a chain of people to pass them along. You know, if there's any slippery patches, you know, no one wants to be carrying the bird the whole way if they're ducking and going over logs and down rocks and stuff. So it's just a chain of the whole bird crew passing the bird along so that it's safely transported through the terrain.
So like fire brigade style?
Exactly. And the other thing that we haven't mentioned to you is that what the field crew does is hike them to a landing area where then the birds are taken in a helicopter by one of our trained staff to an area close to the road where then they can be driven to the house where they're kept for a few days before we take them to Honolulu. So the birds get to go by many modes of transportation, foot, helicopter, car, and airplane to get to Honolulu Zoo.
And so you're almost done with the collection phase of these Anianiao. You are standing up this program that's going to be at the Honolulu Zoo. Give us a bit of a timeline on that and what else this program is going to entail.
So the idea is that these birds will be introduced to each other and hopefully form mating pairs and produce offspring of their own. But 10 birds is not, or even 12 birds is not enough to start a captive flock if you can have more birds, because you want a lot of different founders. You don't really know what's going to happen down the road. And so we are going to continue in the spring collecting eggs from Anianiao nests. And the goal is to collect 30 to 40 Anianiao eggs that hopefully will turn into a couple dozen more Anianiao adults. And those ones will go to San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance's facility on Maui. And then I think the idea would be, like any cooperative zoo program, they could potentially move birds from Honolulu to breed with birds in Maui and vice versa to find the optimal pairing so that we could have a viable breeding flock of this species that acts as an insurance population.
And I guess the big picture question there for me is, how do you think about these insurance populations and these captive monitored populations as, you know, a tool in your tool belt of conservation?
Right. I mean, right now we are still figuring out how to control mosquitoes at the landscape scale, and mosquito-borne disease is the primary threat, right? So the other option is to remove birds from the threat of avian malaria, and that's what we're doing with this conservation breeding flock. And we feel like by diversifying partners, working with San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance and with Honolulu Zoo, we're bringing a lot of different expertise that hopefully will provide a really viable and robust flock. I mean, no one wants to arrive at this point with an endangered species. I mean, when you get to the point where you're doing conservation breeding for species, it's because all your other options have not come to fruition, or you've acted too late, or you, in some cases, you discover the species when they're on the brink of extinction. But it is a really, really important and valid tool. And for example, that's the only reason why Alala aren't completely extinct, right? They're extinct in the wild, but they're not extinct because we had a conservation breeding flock that was started by only a handful of individuals and now numbers more than 100 Alala. For many other species across the world, these conservation breeding programs have kept species from going extinct and have led to situations where they can repopulate their former range, which is the goal with the Anianiao. I mean, we are hoping by acting so early with Anianiao that what will happen is that the population we're creating in captivity will supplement a population that is protected by mosquito control. And so we will have an edge in the numbers game. That's our ultimate goal. Whereas with some of the other species we work on, basically they're extinct in the wild. And so our only hope is the captive breeding flock. And we're hoping that we can reintroduce them into areas where we've done mosquito control once mosquitoes are suppressed in those areas. So we're hoping that Anianiao will have kind of a rosier future than some of these other species.
Once these birds are at the Honolulu Zoo, is there going to be the eventual possibility of groups of people seeing them or interacting with them?
So to my understanding, for the foreseeable future, they are off exhibit. Does that mean that select birds couldn't be displayed or select groups couldn't see them? I don't know. That's a question for Honolulu Zoo. I think what we are really hoping is that we can bring these birds to a new population, a population that visits the Honolulu Zoo that maybe doesn't know a whole lot about Kauai's honeycreepers or even Hawaiian honeycreepers in general, through, for example, webcams that are on their cages that are then fed to monitors throughout the zoo, so that even though the people can't walk right up to their cages, they can still see an Anianiao doing its thing in its cage while they're visiting the zoo. And we could have an educational panel in that part of the zoo saying, did you know, just out of sight is one of our remaining honeycreepers here in Hawaii, and this is why we're doing what we're doing with it. So I think we're going to look to find funding to partner with Honolulu Zoo to do outreach and education in ways we can, given that the birds, for now, at least need to be off exhibit.
That was Kylie Crampton and Nicole Suckow of the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project. They were talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Since their discussion, the team has captured the two birds that they were monitoring, and they've transferred them to the Maui Bird Conservation Center. We did check with the city to see what steps the Honolulu Zoo may be taking to protect its resident birds from the potential spread of avian flu, now that we have our first case in the wild out in Wahiawa. And the city says it has closed its walk-in aviary to the public, and the waterfowl that were located at the zoo entrance have been moved to another enclosure. It may also institute additional measures if necessary.
Saturday night on The Real Deal, big hits of 24. That's 1924. Songs of 100 years ago, heard in original and later versions that are still in circulation today. That's the real deal. Member supported HPR 1, 8 to 10 Saturday night.
Support for HPR comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. The Spring Wind Quintet performs music of Rameau, Ravel, and Coleman November 23rd at Doris Duke Theater and November 24th at Palikū Theater. Tickets at chambermusichawaii.org.
Now it's time to sweeten up your day with the answer to the backyard quiz. Earlier, we dove into the history of LA County's smallest city, which was named after a Prohibition-era fruit stand. City officials leaned into its island-themed name. Historic photos from the 1970s show politicians bearing grins and wearing aloha shirts and lei. There were some other parallels with the Aloha State, too. This city had its own brush with an aerial invasion during World War II, during what came to be known as the Battle of Los Angeles. That invasion was reportedly a false alarm, but residents throughout Southern California swarmed the city to work at the nearby aircraft assembly plants. Unlike Hawaii, gambling is legal, and the local casino brings in 65% of that city's revenue. For today's quiz, we asked you to name this city, which is Hawaiian Gardens. And our winner today, Mike from Kaimuki, says he used to live near there, and he says it's an oddball of a place. And Mike, I've never been, but I will take your word for it. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Production on a local short film titled Grace starts this month. It's based on a true story of two women who fall in love in 1950s Oahu, a Hawaiian woman named Grace and a Caucasian woman named Ruth. Ruth will be played by local actress Elizabeth Rion, who wrote the script. She is also a descendant of the real-life Ruth. In addition to the love story, the film explores themes of cultural suppression and colonial influence against the backdrop of U.S. statehood. The conversations, Russell Subiano sat down with Rion and the film's director, Jana Park, in our studio. Rion starts us off.
I didn't see stories like this being told. And it is my opinion that if you don't see what you want out there, make it yourself. If you have the talent and the means to do it. Both of which I have, not to toot my own horn, but beep, beep. And this script is really important to me, and I'm thrilled that I get to see it come to life.
Jana, as a director, what attracted you to the project?
It's about the silencing of gender, of sexual orientation, of your nation. There's a lot of themes having to do with Hawaiians losing their kingdom, and this is set during statehood, where most of the folks in this story are celebrating statehood, but a couple of our characters are not, and they can't really be open with that. So those themes drew me in, and we've cultivated an incredible local team here of artists to make film that we are blessed to work with. So we have a lot of friends coming onto this film, and that appealed to me too. Anytime we get to come together as a community with our friends and tell an important story.
We're starting to see a lot of films coming out depicting different points in Hawaii's history. I don't know that we've seen people's feelings about statehood in a film just yet. What are your thoughts on these films that are coming out that are depicting parts of Hawaii's history that haven't been on screen before?
So I think when we're telling stories about Hawaii, there's kind of two parts to it. The first part is telling the story for Hawaii's people so that they can see themselves represented and honoring them and honoring that history. But also, maybe more important, is getting the stories outside of Hawaii to the continent, internationally, to let people know what happened here. And I think that's really important. And there's a growing interest as to what exactly went down in Hawaii. What is the status of Hawaii? You know, John Oliver did an incredible piece on Last Week Tonight covering a lot of issues, and they really hit it well. And I think that's things like that. They're coming up and they're sparking more interest across the world. I've had other filmmakers, even from England, see Ciara Lacey's film, The Queen's Flowers, that just won at HIFF. And from England, at a Wales Film Festival, she reached out and said, wow, we saw this and we loved it and it touched us. So these stories are resonating with people across the world. You know, there's more talk about indigenous people. And, you know, this film is about colonization of bodies, of a kingdom. And when we talk about statehood, there's this notion that everyone was for it and everyone was so excited. And even in my own family, I grew up with an adopted Japanese father who told me my whole life, like, we're so lucky that we are American. We would have been speaking German or Japanese. And ironically, he's Japanese. But it was said with this disdain, like, oh no, you know, we're saved. And it wasn't, even for myself growing up on Molokai, I didn't really know the full story until I went back to college and took, you know, Hawaiian history. And I had a very progressive professor who taught us everything and exposed me to authors and films that opened my eyes, even as a local person. So I think these films are so important for Hawaii's people, for the keiki to see, for the next generation, for people who are moving here, and then for outside.
Elizabeth, you'll be playing the role of Ruth in the film, one of the leads. And you mentioned this earlier, characters in the film are based on family members. What kind of research did you have access to when you were writing your script? What can you tell us about these characters that are based on your family?
I didn't have a ton of research available to me. My grandmother died about 10 years ago, and with her, a lot of that history that I didn't, unfortunately, have enough time to talk to her about. She also would not have been entirely forthcoming, and she only had her limited opinion. And she told me about statehood and dancing in the streets and making lei and taking the girls down to celebrate at the palace. And that was her own myopic viewpoint on that. I've been able to do some research with my mother, who has shown me multiple family photos and pictures say 1,000 words. I've also been lucky enough to dig through some letters that give character to who these people were. My mom gave me like a 10-page document that my grandmother wrote with instructions to her sister on how to take care of the girls while she was out of town. And it's funny and it's interesting and it gives you insight into how she lived her life and how controlling she was and how caring. So it's been really interesting to read letters that are written in my grandmother's handwriting, to read postcards from Ruth to her friends when she was traveling and teaching. So a lot of my research has been letters, postcards, and photographs. As an actor, when I do research on a character, I'm a very visual person. I want to see them. I want to see their little tics and the way that they move. And I never got the chance to do that. She died before I was born, and there are no videos of her. Only photographs and only stories. So I can only piece together in my own imagination what she would have been like and how to translate that into my own performance of her.
Jaina, you will begin production on this at the end of November. Elizabeth is cast as Ruth. You recently landed another talented actor to play the other lead, Grace. Some moviegoers may recognize her. Can you talk about her?
We're very, very excited and honored to have Lindsay Watson star as Grace. And many have seen her in Finding Ohana on Netflix. And she starred in Wind in the Reckoning with Jason Scott Lee. And she's incredible. We're going to be flying her in from Los Angeles. And she and Elizabeth have a lot of chemistry. And we've already rehearsed. And it was incredible. So we're just really excited.
One theme I see running through the production side of the film is the opportunities for women. The film is about women, written by a woman, directed by a woman. On the website, the production crew features women. Is it all women?
Almost.
Almost all women.
It's been a very, very intentional choice for Elizabeth and I as executive producers that everyone on this crew be enthusiastic about being on the film, but also be an underrepresented voice on the crew side. So that means women. That means queer people and Pacific Islanders. So literally everyone except for one person is either female, queer, or Pacific Islander, or a combination of all that. And we have been really lucky to receive some grant money, and we've done some fundraising and had some generous donors. And part of that mission is to give Pacific Islanders opportunities that they may not otherwise have.
This story is clearly important to both of you. It's a story about your ancestors, it's a story about Hawaii history, but it's also about human relationships. When it's all said and done, what kind of impact do you hope it has?
I hope that people can watch this film and relate to it, at least relate to one of the characters in the film, and hopefully feel a sense of connection across time and across cultures. And my ultimate hope is that it hopefully opens some eyes to not only what went down here in Hawaii and what's, you know, currently happening, and pique that interest of people, but also to think about the silencing of culture, of gender, of sexual orientation, just of women to be women, and to think about how has that happened in my own family, how is that happening now, and to talk about it.
Well, before Mark Zuckerberg said it, E.M. Forster said, only connect. And I think, going off of what Jaina just said, connection is the most important thing that I want people to take from this, whether it's women connecting to the story, Native Hawaiians connecting to the story, people anywhere who have been silenced or told to be ashamed or have been ashamed for who they are and what they stand for and what they believe in and what they love and who they love. I hope they feel some sense of being seen and understood and not alone. I also am a descendant of people who came to Hawaii who were not from here originally. And I think it is my kuleana, I feel it is my kuleana, to connect people and give back in the most meaningful way that I can to this place that has given me so much. And for me, that's through storytelling. I think it's unfair of people to come to Hawaii with this very haole mindset of what can I take and get? And I think it's important to instead connect with your community and think, how do I fit in with this community? How do I connect with them? What can I give? What is my story to tell? And I hope that this brings us all together in that way, and that our production is a reflection of our values.
Jaina Park, Elizabeth, Rian, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
That was director Jaina Park and writer-actress Elizabeth Rian talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. Their film, Grace, is to start production later this month. Check our website for links later today. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we learn about how Native cultures are using language to navigate the science of geothermal energy. Got feedback for us? Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.